Jürgen Korn, Yukon Housing.
Hello, I'm beginning the ductless heat pump webinar. Thank you for participating. This is being brought to you by Pacific Gas and Electric's Energy Training Center. ACI is the host and sponsor. We'll be referring to the page number on the slides, and I apologize for the annoying dings. I thought I had turned that off, but apparently did not. So second slide, everyone should have a PDF that they received a link to downloading from our website. The disclaimer slide indicates that the presenter's experience and knowledge and opinions do not represent PG&E. The third slide, objectives, one thing I'd like to point out is in the third objective, when we're talking about opportunities, limitations, applications, there are a variety of different applications for ductless heat pumps, and depending on what your context is, you get a different, perhaps a different view. The folks who are participating in the call represent a wide range of interest, those looking at ductless heat pumps from a program perspective, as well as people who may be looking at ductless heat pumps as a how do I get to net zero or how to get close to net zero, either in a staged or retrofit application. So keep in mind we've got just a variety of ways of thinking about the value and opportunities and challenges and limitations of ductless heat pumps. So on to slide four. This is the outline. We're covering a lot today. Today is not going to have much discussion, even among the leaders, session leaders. We're going to organize your comments and questions, and Thursday will be more interactive. So this is my email address. If you need to reach me during the webinar, put today or now in the subject line. We will be integrating your feedback for the Thursday call, and we can have some of you on the call as well. So I'm going to do a brief introduction to the 1,000 Home Challenge. We normally do a webinar once every month or so. That's an introduction to the 1,000 Home Challenge. So this is just a sneak preview of that. The 1,000 Home Challenge is in its pilot. It's an ACI initiative. The goal of the 1,000 Home Challenge is to demonstrate 70 to 90% reductions across North American housing stock as part of contributing to what many, many folks realize is the need for transforming North American housing stock. The energy efficiency is the cornerstone, and there are three what you could call wild cards, these being behavioral choices, renewables, or community solutions. I'm on slide six. We do not dictate how you mix and match those resources in order to meet the 1,000 Home Challenge. The key metric we use to define energy use is net annual household site energy. Each household has its unique threshold. And on slide eight, there are two ways of determining your threshold. One is based on current use. If you've got defensible, verifiable previous use that's recent within the past year or so, you can achieve a 75% reduction, and that meets the criteria. The second way of defining your threshold is appropriate for those that don't have verifiable energy use or those that are already much lower than average energy use, and in that case, we use a number of factors, household size, climate, number of occupants, which isn't listed here, and what type of fuel or way that you heat in order to determine an allowance that would apply to either your household or your building. If you look at the next couple slides, we've got bar graphs. I'm on slide nine, and you'll see your threshold would be for a typical household of three with 2,000 square feet of finished floor area, and this is assuming electric heat in 10 different communities across California. Truckee is closer to the rest of northern U.S. with, depending on how you define degree days, somewhere around 7,000 degree days a year. These other areas have much lower heating degree days, usually 1 to 3,000. But what you'll notice right away in looking at this slide, slide 9, is that the red and orange part of these bars, which represent all space conditioning, are actually a pretty low portion of the total use. And while the total use, the green, might look like a lot and blue might look like a lot in comparison, these thresholds are very challenging and impressive, I guess you would say, if a household achieves total energy use of 5,000 kilowatt hours a year. That's substantially less than normal. So if you look at slide 10, this is the same inputs as the previous slide, but the red bar shows the additional allocation if you're heating with natural gas or propane or wood. We do allow for a bigger allocation because those energy systems are less efficient. On slide 11, you'll see a comparison of CO2 emissions. This is based on PG&E's information for 2009, at least for electricity. There are a couple of things I'd like to point out on this slide that I think are interesting. One is that your CO2 emissions would be the same regardless of whether or not you're all electric or you've got gas, space, and water heating if you meet option B. And this is a house, I believe, in San Francisco. So it's Bay Area climate. And in both cases, if you meet option B, you're well under what the CO2 emissions would be for an average PG&E residential customer just looking at their electric use. So a lot of things to ponder there. Important thing to recognize is that the rest of the country tends to have much higher CO2 per kilowatt hour. Next slide. This shows the impact of square footage, house size. The colder it is, the more that a larger house will give you a larger threshold, but it's not three times the size. So there are some key questions for 1,000 Home Challenge projects. What makes sense if you're using a small amount? How much should you invest in the system, and what does that system need to do throughout the season and throughout the life cycle of your household? And, you know, what are the options that we can take that are on the path that don't end up getting in the way? And it's my belief that ductless heat pumps could be a very good transitional and long-term solution as people have an existing heating system that they consider adding and supplementing and as they go through a staged retrofit. So with that, we're going to start with Mark Jerome, who spent his adult life working with HVAC systems in a variety of ways, and he certainly understands the practical field reality as well as the challenge as a trainer and being involved in quality assurance and understanding what it takes to operate a program and invest in ductless heat pumps as an energy efficiency strategy. So with that, Mark, it's yours.
All right. Thank you very much. On the slide 15, we're going to talk about ductless heat pumps. Here's a picture of basically the major components of the ductless heat pump. And slide 16, EHP technology. Millions have been installed worldwide. They've been around for around 30 years. Recent technology updates have thrust them into the forefront of the HVAC market with promises of energy savings. Homes striving to achieve deep energy reductions could benefit from this technology. So we're going to talk briefly about the refrigeration cycle. We're not creating heat, we're moving heat from inside to outside or outside to inside, depending on the season. Slide 18. My presentation is going to be based around the technology differences between ductless and conventional ducted heat pumps, the differences of installation and field experience. Slide 19, how are ductless heat pumps different? They have inverter compressors, different expansion valves, they have defrost differences, and their user interface controls are different. Slide 20, DHP compressor. This is an inverter block diagram. So this basically explains how we take AC voltage, convert it to DC voltage, smooth it and condition it, turn it into a three-phase voltage that the compressor can use. That way we can vary that compressor up and down. So that's the major difference. Slide 21, DHP compressor operation. An inverter control speeds the DC motor controller, controlling the frequency and the power that's supplied to the motor. So we ramp the speed up when heat is needed or cooling, and then ramp it back down. So it's a variable speed, much like the accelerator of your car. And compared to the common on-off controlled compressors, the inverter controlled compressor is able to run at the proper RPM to provide the best efficiency and reduce capacity losses. So when the maximum capacity is not needed, the compressor speed is decreased, reducing input power, which results in increased system efficiency. Slide 22.
Hey, could you speak up a little bit?
Certainly. Let me see. Volume up a little bit here. There we go. Is that better?
Yep, great.
Okay. Conventional ducted heat pump compressors, when the compressor motor starts, it runs at 3,600 RPM, needs to overcome inertia, has high inrush current, which is somewhat trivial, but still important in some places where we're dealing with peak load issues, continues to draw a high current, and optimum heat transfer is not obtained for up to 15 minutes or until the system reaches a steady condition. The DHP electronic expansion valve. It's a refrigerant flow control driven by a four-phase pulse motor. It has 500-plus stage positioning, which ensures precision refrigerant flow. And fine refrigerant flow also provides a superior room comfort and ensures low waste of energy than conventional systems. Conventional ducted heat pump utilizes a thermostatic expansion valve. The THV is a mechanical device. It's spring-loaded, and it works independent of the thermostat, temperatures, and compressor operation. Slide 25. Defrost cycle comparison. So the defrost for both the DHP and conventional systems are initiated by a sensor in the outdoor unit. The difference is the DHP shuts the indoor and outdoor fan motors off for the most part, closes the damper, and that way there's not cold air blowing inside. And then the conventional system, the outdoor fan motor shut off, but the indoor motor continues to run. The DHP will ramp the compressor up and down when going in and out of defrost to reduce comfort problems, and no electric resistance heat is needed, where in the conventional ducted heat pump, electric resistance heat is activated by a valve in the outdoor unit. And then, in turn, it turns on the electric resistance heat while it goes into air conditioning to defrost the outdoor coil. So this can result in a 20% annual energy penalty as far as usage goes, for and based on field measurements. And then the DHP doesn't need that electric resistance heat to temper that cold air. So we have no compressor noise with the DHP and some compressor noise with defrost and conventional heat pumps, as I'm sure people that have been around the heat pumps have heard before. Slide 26, DHP user interface has many different functions to help the homeowner customize it to how they would like their environment to be. There are optional wired programmable thermostats available. The most important point here is that the indoor temperature is not in that remote unit. It's in the indoor unit. And so making sure that we have a sealed installation where the lines go through to that, so that we're not getting cold air from the outside. And also this thing will operate whether you lose your remote into the trunk of your car or into the seats of your couch, because the sensor is in the indoor unit. Conventional ducted heat pump thermostat, 527. They're wall-mounted in a central location, providing whole-house temperature control. There is no lockout for warm air temperature for resistance heat. So if you turn the heat up, your auxiliary heat will come on unless you have that optional outdoor sensor to lock that out at warm temperatures. And then the unit will cycle on and off to maintain temperature control rather than operating at a little bit speed. So the slide 28, the DHP and conventional technology differences. One has an inverted compressor for more efficient operation. The other has a compressor that runs at one speed, not quite as efficient. The DHP has an electronic expansion valve for precise control. The other one has the thermostatic expansion valve, less precise. We have a superior defrost control with less energy consumption versus the use of electric resistance heat. We have a remote control user interface versus a controller that cycles to maintain temperature control. It is a zonal heat, the DHP, so it may not provide adequate comfort in the entire home where a conventional ducted system would. It has a relatively low output for the indoor units versus a large output with the electric resistance heat. And in some climates, it may not carry the peak load, and homes with envelope issues might not be a good match. So versus where a conventional duct system, the soles can use the system for the sole space conditioning. Slide 29, installation differences. So there's wiring differences, refrigerant tubing installation and best practices differences, condensation drain, installation tools, and commissioning. The DHP wiring differences. The control wiring, there's basically three wires that go from inside to outside and then one cable from your breaker panel to the outdoor unit versus a complex control strategy for a ducted heat pump with two cables from the breaker box, one going to the indoor unit, one going to the outdoor unit. So a little more complex. Slide 31, refrigerant tubing installation differences. So the DHP, no brazing is needed, so it leaves a clean refrigerant system, where a conventional ducted system can leave scale from oxidation. Unless we properly purge the system with nitrogen while brazing, it can plug expansion valves with the oxidation. So best practices for all heat pumps is a proper evacuation and a nitrogen pressure check. Condensation drainage for DHPs. We need to pay particular attention to condensation because now we have a condensation tank inside our living space or our living room possibly, and we need to make sure that we pitch it properly so that the water can run downhill to the outside. And then the final placement of the condensate could cause moisture problems in and around homes, especially in high heat. So we want to make sure that we take our condensate to the proper place. A common mistake when installing ductless heat pumps is that people are not using the proper flare nut. And if you buy a copper tubing that is made with for the DHPs, they come with a flare nut, as seen on the left here, on this unit with a factory-made flare, which is very inadequate. So you have to cut that off, re-flare it, and use the proper flaring and to secure it on to make sure that the system is free from refrigerant leaks. So required tools for DHPs, you got your gauges, your micron gauge, the tank, the vacuum pumps, and then the three on the left, the tubing cutter, torque wrench, and flaring tool. And those differ from slide 36, where the torque wrench and the flaring tool is not needed, but you need an oxygen acetylene or oxyacetylene torch. And that's where, when brazing, you can cause some issues if not properly burst with nitrogen. So slide 37, commissioning conventional ducted heat pumps. So refrigerant gauges are needed to ensure proper levels of refrigerant. Airflow measuring tools like flow hoods or true flow plates are needed to measure the airflow to ensure proper flow across the indoor coil. Thermometers are needed to verify temperature splits, amp probe, voltmeters, and a huge amount of paperwork is needed to make sure that a conventional ducted heat pump is commissioned properly. Slide 38. For DHP commissioning is fairly simple. It's in the installation, proper flare nuts, pressure checking, and evacuation. Verifying, you know, voltage to the outdoor unit, good batteries, the unit comes on and provides heat or cooling are things that we need to verify. And with a compressor that varies voltage frequency, a 500 position expansion valve, numerous sensors, refrigerant gauges are only used to verify that refrigerant is present in the system, and gauges should only be used if there's a problem with the refrigerant system. So, installation summary. Ease of wiring for a DHP compared to at least a complex control voltage wiring for a conventional system. Condensate drain from the indoor living space versus a condensation drain that is not often inside the living space. The DHP has one power cable from the electrical panel, where the conventional has two. We should always have a clean refrigerant tubing installation versus a installation that could be a potential of having the tubing contaminated by improper brazing techniques. Similar tools, slightly less expensive versus, you know, explosive and flammable gases that we have to use. And the ease of commissioning versus complicated commissioning.
Hey, Mark, we've got a couple questions. One
sure.
That came in, do all ductless heat pumps use three-phase or some?
No. In fact, most residential ductless heat pumps are single-phase, 230 volts. There are three-phase units, but they're pretty much gauged for the commercial industry.
Okay, and another question of, does the condensate drain provide a thermal bypass to the outside?
It can, if not properly sealed. It can provide a thermal bypass. So that's one of the important parts of the condensate drain. The wiring and the refrigerant tubing run through the same hole. And if, unless that's sealed properly, you will get a thermal bypass there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. On to field experience, slide 4. Required trainings, service and maintenance, customer interactions, price points in the Northwest, multiple indoor heads, ductless system, that's a tongue twister, and lessons learned. So 41, DHP requires training. Okay, and so each manufacturer has a 4 to 8 hour training specific for their ductless heat pump. And in the Pacific Northwest, utilities providing incentives require attendance at a best practices webinar and a contractor orientation webinar. Service and maintenance. All systems should be maintained by a certified technician. Refrigerant gauges should not be used to verify refrigerant levels on DHPs, and there's usually one or two washable filters and often a specific filter unique to that manufacturer, like a carbon ionizing electrostatic filter or something along those lines that may have to be changed once every year or two. Homeowner education is going to be the key to its satisfaction. So we want to make sure that that we educate our homeowner on the operator remote control, how to clean the filter, how often it should be serviced, realistic expectations regarding the distribution compared to past experiences. So if they've had a ducted system in the past, this is not going to give them that same level of total home comfort. So, and then awareness of interactions with other space conditioning systems. So if you have a wood stove that you're heating your home with and a ductless heat pump and you do not set the control properly and set it to automatic, warm the space up, the ductless heat pump's high on the wall, it gathers heat, brings on the air conditioning, you'd be cooling and heating your home at the same time. So we need to make sure that customers are aware of those interactions. Price points, 44. So this is around where I live, and the typical installation price is about $3,000 to $5,000 for a single head ductless heat pump, depending on the difficulty area and contractor, with most of them running about $3,500 to $4,000. Multiple head installation. So if you want to have one outdoor system with two indoor systems, usually you can add about $1,000 extra for each indoor head to that price. Multiple indoor head systems could serve areas that have difficult floor plans, and they've yet to be monitored. There's quite a few that we've put in the Pacific Northwest, and they seem to be a very nice comfort device. So ducted ductless heat pumps. These units have air handlers that allow for a very small amount of ducts. So conventional duct sizing will cause problems that could reduce energy savings and certainly compromise comfort. VFR systems, variable flows. This is the commercial version of the ductless heat pump. So these things can heat and cool at the same time and are being put in government buildings, schools. I've seen quite a few going into commercial buildings that are concerned with use also. So lessons learned and challenges from the field. So I'm going to go through the list of pros and cons here. So they provide air conditioning in homes without ducts. They can reduce use of expensive fuels or inefficient space conditioning. They can complement other ducted or non-ducted systems, like a wood stove or a place where they may have had a window air conditioning. They could be used in lieu of a central system or as its own heating device in low-load homes. And the cons are the appearance, can be objectionable to some. There is a condensate drain in the indoor unit that may be near your living space and near your couch or something along those lines that may need to be done properly, or that might rain inside. And it may not meet all the space conditioning you need for moderate use homes. So slide 50, a well-installed DHP leads to sales from satisfied homeowners. A poor installation here where it just doesn't look very well set on hollow core concrete blocks. The line sets looks very shabby, and the drain is not done very well. You know, we don't want jobs like that out there. And slide 52 here is a picture of two units rather than a multiple head unit. I think the upfront costs are probably a little more. Quite possibly, depending on the load and the use in the home, might be the right answer compared to a multiple head system. Multiple head system might be a better upfront cost and maybe a quicker payback, though. Field experience. So we do need contractor training and maintenance. The pros and cons are driven by house type and installation. And informed customers are key to acceptance and success of DHPs and the future success of DHPs. So, and then prices are often less expensive than alternatives. And my final thoughts are inverter technology and control strategy of ductless heat pumps have many energy-saving applications in new and existing homes. And then proper application installation are keys to the successful future of DHPs. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. A couple of questions that came in was one that was, how do you know if you put the right amount of refrigerant in if you don't test the refrigerant?
Oh, these systems come with a certain amount of refrigerant for a particular length of line set so that you can install up to that length of line set with these systems. And in most cases, it's enough to cover most installations. They do have a refrigerant guide, so if you have to run a longer line set than the conventional length, you add a certain amount based on the extra length of line set, and then that's the end of it. So, no gauges needed besides just the installation or problems.
And what would be the length that you typically could install the inside unit from the outside?
It varies with manufacturer and size of unit. So I've seen anywhere from 24 foot all the way up to 180 foot without having to add extra refrigerant. So it just depends on which manufacturer, which size, which model number, efficiency, and so forth.
Okay, Mark Rosenbaum, you have a comment? Mark? Must be muted. Okay, I'll take care of that. Well, thank you very much, Mark.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
We're going to move on to Bob Davis, who has has 20 years of experience of measuring the performance of a variety of things, whether it be the building enclosure or the mechanical system. And right now, he's the manager of two different year-long projects that are evaluating the installed performance of ductless heat pumps. So his experience hails from Ecotope and the Pacific Northwest. So with that, Bob, it's yours.
Okay, thanks, Linda. Is the sound level okay?
Sounds okay to me.
Sounds good.
All right. Okay, very good. So I guess I'm starting on slide 56. My presentation will focus primarily on some field results from a 95-house study of single-family homes that was begun about 2 years ago and is now mostly complete in the data collection phase. Some preliminary analysis has been done, and that's what will be presented here. Slide 57. The main topics to be covered will be an overview of where the homes are and their characteristics. The savings results that we've gotten so far, some mention of efficiency results, meaning actual coefficient of performance measurements, both from field research and some controlled laboratory testing, which we also supervise as part of the project. Some discussion of customer satisfaction, and then the latter part of the presentation will look at the economics of this technology in the Northwest with some effort to extend it to Northern California. The slide 58, the primary goal of our study was to see how much of the home's existing heating load could be offset by use of the ductless heat pump. And in our case, this study, most of the installations in the study, over 90 of them, were single indoor unit and a single outdoor unit. in the single indoor unit placed in the main living area of the home. In Mark's presentation, he did mention that it is possible to get multiple indoor unit systems, in some cases paired up with one outdoor unit, others with more than one outdoor unit, but for reasons mostly of consumer and utility and regional economics, this study focused on one-to-one systems. If that is the focus, then you have a smaller installation cost and the economics should be better for a given amount of savings. In the Pacific Northwest, we still have about 2 million houses, apartments, and small businesses that use zonal electric-resistant heat, such as baseboards, wall heaters, radiant ceiling or wall cable heat. This is a consequence of relatively inexpensive electricity that's produced by the Clem River hydroelectric system. Also, inexpensive for us means that most or pretty much all of the utilities that sell electricity in the Northwest sell it at less than a dime a kilowatt hour. Many of the public utilities sell it at rates considerably less than that. So that does create challenges for the economics, which in other parts of the country are those prices are pretty different. We will look some at fossil fuel cost comparisons as well in the economic section of this presentation. In our study, this is slide 59, we had a median house size of about 1,800 square feet, a mix of homes with basements and crawl space over built over crawl spaces. Most of these homes are fairly well insulated because most homes heated with electricity in the Northwest have gone through one or more rounds of weatherization. I wouldn't call these homes terribly airtight. 10 air changes at 50 is about the average, but some have gone through some amount of air sealing. We do have for most of the Northwest region a relatively mild climate. However, there are some exceptions, which we'll look at. The heating loads, a wide range there. West of the mountains, 10,000 kilowatt hours per year for heating is about average. On the east side of the region, closer to the Rockies, the amount is about twice that. There are a significant number of homes on the Pacific coast that have even smaller heating loads. Cooling loads are very small in the Northwest. Many places have no electric heat cooling, or if they do have mechanical cooling, it might be one or two window air conditioners. New homes, however, have a higher fraction, which has central air conditioning, even though it's not used very much. What this means for us is the extent that we would get any cooling savings by using a ductless heat pump versus an existing system, this is a relatively minor part of the annual heating and cooling usage. It also means that for some sites, they now have cooling with a ductless heat pump and they didn't before, so there's a bit of a take back on the overall savings that one gets during the heating season. Slide 60 shows just a rough schematic, and these circles and dots and so on show not our study sites, but the larger pilot program that the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance ran, of which the study sites are contained within. So you see a large number of installations on the west side, Seattle, Portland area, some concentration, eastern Washington, western Idaho, some concentration around Boise. And then the far right and lower ellipse is eastern Idaho. Climate there are very similar to what Linda showed for Truckee, 8,000 to 9,000 heating degree days, day 65, an average of around 20,000 kilowatts per year in heating energy for the homes in our study. So that part of the region is considerably more aggressive heating climate. To touch very briefly on the technology used to collect data, we have a data logger with an integral cell phone modem in it, or actually more like an antenna, that automatically sends data back to our servers via an intermediate point 4 times a day. The data goes through error checking to make sure there aren't problems, and if there are problems found via automated error checking then fixes are made either by communicating with the logger or by sending someone out to the site. This is a 5-minute averages, so a lot of data, but that allows a very fine look, fine sieve and sort through all that, through the data, and we can see very clearly what's going on with the ductless heat pump. We also are looking at any electric resistance heat, which is also being used because, again, the study is designed to look at the offset of the existing heating load, we don't assume that people will stop using electric resistance, especially in the rooms of the house, which are not affected by the ductless heat pump, the back rooms. Slide 62, for a subset of our houses, we also looked at the indoor unit in more detail. We measured temperature going in and temperature coming out of the unit, and also measured the indirectly with a small anemometer on the top of the device, which is yellow on the upper left, hard to see. We measured how much airflow was going through, and then we calibrated that with an additional with a handheld device on the right side, so that when we had a given number of RPMs in our leave behind device, we could assign an airflow number to that, and along with our temperature split could find out how much thermal output we're getting from our heat pump. We could compare that then with the amount of energy going into the ductless heat pump circuit and calculate the COP coefficient performance as a function of outdoor temperature. This was very useful in describing how much energy the house would have used from electric resistance if the ductless heat pump wasn't there, and was useful in calibrating our lab measurements as well. I'm going to skip over slide 63. So slide 64 is meant to just to give a very quick description of how the typical measurements would look. This is a 4-day period, and this is a combination of all the main channels we were looking at. The orange line shows the total usage by the house, and these are power numbers over on the left. So if you were to integrate these with time, you'd get actual energy usage in kilowatt hours. In this case, the green at the bottom is the ductless heat pump usage, and in late January in Idaho Falls, it's cold, and so the ductless heat pump, as you can see, is running pretty much all the time and using about 1 kW on average. There is some amount of electric resistance usage in the blue, and I don't have outdoor temperature on here, but you can see time of day anyway, and fairly significant cold periods in Idaho Falls. So we still will see electric resistance usage. It's different every house to house. This is pretty typical. We also looked at hot water usage as an accessory, since we were measuring the other main loads in the house, since the Northwest hadn't had a good hot water field measurement data set in quite some time. Slide 55. There's a fair number of things going into this slide, but I want you just to notice a couple of things. What we did is we normalized the weather between the post-ductless period and the pre-ductless period to make that part of the comparison level. In this case, the blue bar represents the heating usage estimated by looking at the whole bill, electric bill for the house, and using what's called variable base degree day regression. Those of you who are familiar with PRISM will be familiar with this, but the method separates or attempts to separate the base load, that is the non-heating usage and cooling usage, from the whole bill and pull out the heating part of it. So that's the blue bar. And then the green and red on the right side of these pairs, those are the ductless heat pump usage in red and the electric resistance usage that's still in the house in green. And the sum of those two is the total amount of heat going to the house. So in this case, this is a fairly, high savings or even typical savings site, about 47% savings on heating energy use. And these are for comparisons month by month for a subset of all the months we looked at. other sites were pretty different. This was another site from eastern Idaho. Not a whole lot of change over the period of interest. Really, pretty much no change. At this site, there were a combination of things going on. For one thing, the homeowners still seemed to use a fair amount of or a lot of electric resistance. They didn't change their usage patterns very much. And also, in this case, they had a one-ton indoor unit in places like Idaho Falls because of the higher heating loads. The houses that tended to do somewhat better were smaller. This was a little larger than average house, and also tended to use larger indoor units. 1.5-ton units were more common than 1-ton units. So those are some possible explanations. Another case, this one in Seattle, a similar result overall to the last one. This is a longer comparison period. In this case, what happened, as far as we could tell, is that the homeowner did have the unit installed, but didn't take much initiative in actually turning it on very much. And as a matter of fact, some months hardly use it at all. And when we talked to the homeowner, he just said he had somewhat lost interest in using the ductless heat pump. And so in this case, we didn't see much change, or actually a little bit of an increase in usage. So again, a case where the homeowner had much more influence on what happened than the technology itself, which is a fairly significant thing to keep in mind. Slide 68 shows just a scatter plot of all of our sites. This is 84 of the sites because the analysis is still being finalized, but does show that, for the most part, the zero line is the darker line going from left to right in the middle, that we did have savings on most of our cases. Some cases, very significant savings of well over 50 or even 75% of the electric heat usage. This one's plotted so that the bigger users, pre-ductless heat pumper to the right and the ones that use less to the left, not really much correlation, but it's a useful way of looking at it. Because in general with these sorts of things, with the ductless heat pump work we've done, the larger users on average do tend to save more as a percentage. On the cooling side, 569, we don't have a lot of mechanical cooling in the Northwest, or a lot in terms of how much energy people use to keep their houses cool. Many spots in the Northwest, there's no air conditioning at all. And we also don't have any latent cooling to speak of, meaning it's all sensible cooling. There isn't a lot of moisture in the summertime. So there's plenty in the winter. That's a different issue. But here's a couple of examples of a couple different houses. And in this case, we have two different summertime profiles. The left side, if you look at that one for the moment, the outside air temperature is the red line. And really, this shows fairly typical summer weather for the Northwest, where, yes, it got over 80 degrees. For parts of one day, but generally it was in the 60s to mid-70s, the nighttime temperatures in the 60s, and no ductless heat pump usage at all. On the right side, we had what for us is a fairly significant heat wave, temperatures in the 90s and even over 100 degrees, a couple cases. And yes, there is some ductless heat pump usage, which are the blue bars down below, but the blue bars are just showing kind of the kilowatt-hour usage per five-minute period in these instances. These are hourly usages. But the accumulated usage for this whole heat wave period was about 7 kilowatt-hours. And this represented a significant amount of the mechanical cooling for this site for the entire summer. Next slide, slide 70. A different house with the similar temperatures on the right side anyway, where there's more cooling going on, you see a lot more ductless heat pump usage. But again, if you summed it all up for that entire week, only about 26 kilowatt hours total. So yes, there's cooling. The numbers don't don't accumulate very high in most parts of the Northwest, but in cases where the homeowner didn't have any air conditioning before the ductless heat pump, there will be more usage in the summer than there used to be. In the final analysis, we will be accounting for that as a kind of a decrement to the heating savings. On the COP side, slide 71, this just shows actual measured coefficient performance values. And as a function of outdoor temperature, these are for heating. We have some for cooling, but heating is more interesting to us. Left side, COP is down that bin where we're under 10 degrees Fahrenheit still. Well, they vary between about 1.5 and 3, but the middle of the box, which is a little hard to see, is over 2. There's a middle line. You can see a little better on the ones to the right. That's the median COP. As you would expect, as temperatures get milder in heating, COPs go up. And a lot of our data for these systems, when we measure in the field, shows COPs well over 3 for much of the time that they're actually running. So here's the actual heating season savings numbers for different parts of our region. There's quite a range. These are the actual kilowatt hours, not percentage savings, but a range from about 1,800 kilowatt hours up to around 4,500. The average across the region is about 3,500 kilowatt hours. On a percentage basis, slide 73, a range from about 17% up to about 50%, the overall average being about 35% of the pre-ductless heat pump usage. The low number in the Spokane area has to do with, and we still have to finalize it, but we tried our best to find sites for the study that did not use wood heat or propane or other uses that would tend to mask the electric heat usage. And in some parts of the region, it was much harder to find sites, and we had to include some of those cases. So that's what you're seeing in at least the ones that are included in this summary for Spokane and to some degree for the Boise cluster.
So and what you're saying is there could be a higher savings in terms of heating if you're looking at all heating sources, but this is only looking at the electric heating savings.
Yeah, and it also points out that if you're trying to run a program with incentives for reducing electric heat usage by installing ductless heat pumps, that if you don't screen for those things, your overall savings, electric heat will be much diminished. So in other words, people will start to use more electricity for heating than they did before, but they may use less wood. That may be okay depending on how you're counting things, but it's not so okay if you're trying to put less load on the electric grid by putting ductless heat pumps.
Right. I think that, because Linda, am I unmuted yet?
Yes.
Oh, all right. So this is Mark Rosenbaum. One of the things that I think we're seeing here in the East, Bob, is unless if people are actually buying wood,
yes,
it costs them more per delivered BTU than the heat pumps.
Yeah.
So the people who are economically motivated and may have turned to wood or even pellet fuels, for instance, to shed dollars of that have been spent for fossil fuels, may go back because the heat pumps
yeah.
are cheaper.
No, I'm not inherently against it. Or yes, the issue is, or if we can put a valuation on the convenience factor or the better air quality factor or the global warming factor for burning less wood. It seems like a reasonable thing to do. It's just if you're basically trying to buy conservation, it doesn't go as well with you know, offsetting wood or propane or something like that.
Yes.
So that's just a conundrum right now we have in the Northwest. There is a larger billing analysis that's going to happen for all, I don't know, about 3,500 of these installations. And we won't see 35% savings because it will include lots of houses that where this thing is going on. I'm going to go through some of the efficiency results and get to the economic section while there's still time. Let's go to slide 76. And the purpose of this slide is just to mention that when we go out and do field measurements, which are actually the box plots that are kind of in grayscale in the background. And again, the middle line in the box is the median measured value. When we go out and do those measurements with our COP measurement device, and we compare them to what is measured in a controlled lab environment, which is the kind of the red and green and blue dots, and we compare those values with what Fujitsu in this case publishes in their literature, which are the orange dots, we're finding very good agreement for both heating and cooling tests. We tested both Fujitsu products and Mitsubishi, and very good agreement on both. And so this, at least, is preliminary very good news as far as trying to be somewhat confident what the results are from what the manufacturer is saying. There will be a more complete report on this available via some of the links that Linda has at the end, probably in about 8 months. But we have a lot better agreement, look at slide 77, at least for these limited tests, than you might tend to see with other types of comparisons between manufacturers' data and lab testing data. For example, for the Fujitsu 12 RLS in heating zone 4, which is where the values are typically reported, their claim is HSPF 12, our measurement 11.8. Mitsubishi claims about 10.6, our measurement about 9. In very, very cold weather, slide 78, we're seeing COPs of, even when it's below zero for a selected model, COPs of around 2. We installed a set of systems in Helena, Montana and Great Falls in early February of this year and found very impressive performance even in single digits and below zero. Delivered temperatures of 95 to low 100 degree Fahrenheit, and again, COPs of around 2. Slide 79, in general, I think Mark mentioned some of this, but a lot of satisfaction with the product. Some adjustment for some people because they hadn't had this type of system before and they're not familiar with the remote control and cleaning filters and so on, but with some amount of break-in time, people tend to get pretty well accustomed to it, and they, at least for the cases where they are saving a lot, are very happy with how the electric bill looks. Okay, the remainder of the presentation, we're going to look through some economics comparisons, and because we don't all live in the Northwest. And as Linda showed before, look at slide 80, I just picked out, you know, picture California, and there's lots of climate zones there, but in general, very mild heating requirements for much of California, a major exception being Truckee, which is up in the Sierra fairly high. If you look at slide 81, we have Northwest sites on the left side and California on the right. The big peaks are Idaho Falls, which we had some data from before, and Truckee, which is California. Most of the sites off to the right in California are fairly mild. And most of those sites would have more mechanical cooling. The Bay Area is pretty different. As someone once said, it's colder there in the summer than in the winter because of the fog. But overall, considerably milder. Slide 82.
Why there's three different bars for each site?
Oh, well, heating degree days base 65 is the blue bar. That's what people usually use when they talk about heating degree days and make comparisons. But for homes that have some insulation or more than some insulation, it's more suitable to use heating degree days to lower bases. And the base just means the temperature below which you have to add heat to the house to make it comfortable. Some of the newer homes that are very well insulated may have bases down at 50 or even in the high 40s. And so the lower you go, reflecting better insulation and maybe better solar characteristics, the less and less heat you have to add. So if you look at a house, for example, in Oakland, that had, 3,000 heat degrees, say 65. So you put some insulation in it and, you know, air seal it to some degree and all that, And now we look at the heating degree days base 55, the yellow bar, it's less than a third of what we had at 65 degrees for our base. So if you insulate your house, even don't do a very good job, which would be sort of the green bar in the middle, your heating requirements go down quite a bit. And this does link back to 1,000 ohm challenge quite well, meaning especially if you're doing an aggressive job of retrofitting the house, the expectation of how much mechanical heating you have to add is greatly diminished. In the Northwest, of course, we still have a significant number of heating degree days, 55 relative to California, but Portland, you know, it's about cut in half. Other places, similar. So that is the significance of the bars. I also put the learned design temp in. Excuse me. Go ahead, Linda.
The milder the climate, the bigger the percentage impact of that.
Yes. On the cooling side, next slide. Yes, not much cooling in the Northwest versus many California sites, but if you pay attention to window type in the context of retrofit, for example, using Lowy windows as retrofit windows, or provide other shading such as mature landscaping, overhangs, side fins, that sort of thing. Even in California, the cooling loads are quite manageable. And this is just mentioned to point out the benefits of doing various types of retrofits in window selection and other factors. Northwest, Boise, for example, does have on the order of, for the average house, maybe 1,500 kilowatt-hours a year of usage, but that's fairly modest versus that same house having probably a 12 to 15,000 kilowatt-hour usage for heating. Slide 83. This slide, there's a lot going on, but Linda has provided a link to the spreadsheet that this comes from, so you can, and some of you probably already have this spreadsheet in some form or other. But the purpose of the slide is just to show how much it would cost to run a ductless heat pump versus at least a couple other options, which we selected. In this case, the ductless heat pump in the middle there, we're using 20 cent a kilowatt hour electricity to run it. That was just a selection based on a guess at what the average cost might be in California, although with the tiered rates that are coming, that's going to be more challenging to figure out. I put in natural gas as one other comparison at $1.10 a therm, and propane at $4 a gallon, and assigned some efficiencies. In these cases, I didn't include ducts. That's the distribution efficiency or dist efficiency up at the top, third column from the right. If you throw duct losses in, of course, your cost per million BTUs will increase because you're going to lose some of that heat and duct loss. But in this case, with a ductless heat pump with an average system efficiency, or COP of 3, the 300% there you can see, our cost per million BTUs is about $20, $19.53. It costs more to run the ductless in this case than run a gas wall heater or something like that without ducts at $1.10 a therm. Cost per million for that is $13.75. So if you're planning on offsetting natural gas use, at least at the current prices, you may not come out ahead of the ductless. Propane, a little different story. $4 a gallon, may have noticed that it's about where it's going to be or where it is, so you're doing pretty well at the ductless. Now, I did put the wood option in. I didn't put it in color, but it's right below propane, and $2.25 a cord, boy, you're still doing better with ductless, at least at that price. I put a system efficiency, which would be combustion efficiency, basically 60% in. But this is just a more of an operating cost comparison that a consumer might be looking at. We'll keep moving through here. The In our experiment in the Northwest, we're looking at heating. And in fact, that is the dominant load in many cases, not always, but it certainly is in a lot of places west of the mountains and the northern tier. So that's at least our major consideration. If there's a lot of cooling in your area, you can look at that, but it's important to know what those loads really are. If you're also in a very cold place, it's important to select equipment properly because not all these models are designed to work very well when it's below 30 degrees outside. And consumer operation of the unit is very important. We saw some examples up above where things just didn't turn out the way we expected because the consumer choice was the dominant control strategy. Flight 85, yes, in the Northwest, or at least as part of the experiment we were looking at, the consumer economics are more favorable if you are looking at a one-to-one unit with the savings that we're seeing. Once you add on more units, the cost goes up, and we haven't directly measured the savings, but my guess is we will not find favorable economics with multiple systems because of the higher first cost. Flight 86, this just shows the comparison of consumer payback. You're looking at electricity at a couple different cost levels and also natural gas and propane. It shows a range of savings. For our study, with about 3,500 kilowatt-hour average savings, payback to 10 cents a kilowatt-hour, which is what we have in the Northwest, about 10 years. If you're in California with a higher cost of electricity, of course, that's going to be cut in half. Even with the milder savings of about 1,500 kilowatt-hours, which might be more suitable for some of the California cases where the initial usage was smaller, savings, the payback still is not terrible. It's around 12 years. But if you're offsetting natural gas, at a dollar a therm, I guess they used here, on just a simple payback basis, you're not coming out ahead.
But Bob, this is assuming that you're not considering the cost of a system that you're putting in. You're just looking at using a ductless heat pump in conjunction with what you already have, correct?
That's correct. This is just saying that if I put a ductless heat pump in conjunction with my existing system, that I have these levels of savings. This is the benefit of, or the payback of using that ductless in place of what was already there.
Right.
And this assumes an install cost of $3,500. If you're thinking about it from a utility perspective, or at least what we call total resource cost perspective, and this is just thrown in to give an idea of what the Northwest is thinking about, this is where you have discounted paybacks, certain cost of money and an assumption about the cost of electricity, inflation, and operation and maintenance costs, and so on over 15 years. This resource works in the Northwest, even with their 10 cent kilowatt-hour cost. In California, it's a little bit harder to figure out exactly what the avoided cost of electricity is right now, but I used a fairly customary number, and it almost passes the test there. So higher cost of electricity helps somewhat, even with the diminished savings versus what we're seeing in the Northwest. On the peak side, slide 88, there are some potential benefits here. These are smaller systems. The compressors use less peak energy, even on very hot days, 40 to 60% less. But the problem is, depending on the house and what the customer expectations are, you might not keep the whole house cool and comfortable. If the customer is okay with that and having a cool area in the house on those peak days, then this could be a good utility benefit, but it does depend on the customer expectation. So the summary, as Mark mentioned, it's very important to the customer to understand how much of the house can be conditioned. This is on our one-to-one system model. You have a, you know, warm part of the house or a cool part in summer, and the customer is fine with that, and the back rooms maybe can't be kept as comfortable. That's very useful to know. If you start installing multiple units, indoor and outdoor units, and the economics change, if you're adding a ductless heat pump just to get cooling in a place that doesn't have much cooling, it's a nice amenity, but it's not going to really pay off for itself in terms of payback. The final slide, just reiteration. We've had very good results with these units in Northwest on average. There are cases where there hasn't been as much savings, largely due to customer choices. Our experiment was kind of an offset experiment versus total replacement. That's important to keep in mind. I haven't really mentioned it, but it's true, the fourth bullet point here, that depending on how you use the system, they tend to be more efficient and more effective when they're run on a, you know, on a low idle versus the, you know, being turned off and on at night. Turning off at night and on in the morning, although that is also site dependent. And we are doing a new study now where we're looking at this product in sites where there's a central forced air electric furnace, so there's a central thermostat, and so we're trying to see what the interaction is going to be between that and the ductless heat pump. Results to be available about a year from now. Slide 91, there are a number of places you can go to find some of the reports and presentations on the subject. Linda.
Thank you, Bob. We're going to be posting a PDF of additional resources on ductless heat pumps as well, so that will have links to a number of presentations and reports that, in addition to the ones that are listed. So thank you very much, Bob. Now it's time for Mark Rosenbaum to primarily respond with his experience to what's already been presented. Mark has been involved in high-performance buildings for years in the Northeast and is certainly considered the expert from the variety of his project experience. So, Mark, take it from here.
Thanks. Well, I took a bunch of notes during both presentations, and I'm going to just kind of go through them quickly. On Mark Jerome's presentation, just some notes about things that we've observed. One is, in cold climates, we're working really hard to keep the line sets, as much of the line set inside the building instead of outside. So his bad example, one of the things was the line sets all on the outdoors. And so, you know, that starts to make a difference when it's a small heater. The second thing is the question of where the sensor is for that operates the heat pump. And indeed, in most of these wall-mounted units, they come with a sensor in the actual wall unit. Some manufacturers' wired remote controls, the ones that are on the wall and wired, allow you to switch to a sensor in that control, and some don't. And if you want that feature, which we feel is a useful feature, because in some cases, in some manufacturers, having the wired remote as a sensor allows the system to, you can program it so the system shuts the fan off when the thermostat is satisfied, because it no longer needs to bring air over the sensor in the indoor unit. So we have mostly opted for wired controls, even for our single-zone wall cassette units. On the condensate and the question of the thermal bleed to the outdoors, we've worked hard to get the condensate drains running indoors, and we've done a lot of new construction with these, and that, of course, makes it a lot easier. And in general, what we're trying to do is lay things out so we can get our condensate drains to the washing machine trap, because that trap in an occupied house is essentially always wetted. And so trapping these things properly inside is an issue that we've been paying attention to. And
Mark, do you need a condensate drain even if it's just in the heating mode?
No, but we don't believe that anyone that gets the opportunity to use cooling won't use it. So we don't want a puddle on the floor.
Gotcha.
And all my data logging shows me that even, however modest I haven't seen one of these that hasn't, where people haven't used some cooling. So, yeah, we're paying attention to it as if it will be used. In a similar fashion, we've been very focused on what the trades folks are doing with the piping penetrations, because what we're seeing that is, without guidance, what they're going to do is take a 2.5 or 3-inch hole saw and make a hole into your house and then pass the lines into that hole with the insulation on it, and then either foam in place or caulk or some combination of some kind of goo, they're going to shove that in the hole. And that takes about 30 seconds for a rodent to get in your building. So we are making our installers bring the line sets through something rigid, like a piece of trim, you know, it might be just a piece of wood, bare for that, you know, half an inch or 3/4 inch, and insulate up to it on both sides so that we keep pests out of the building. So we're really concerned that these penetrations bring both insects and rodents possibly. Our pricing data looks similar to other things that people have reported. We've used quite a number of the larger multi-port machines, either the single-phase multi-port machines or the true VRF machines that Mark mentioned. And it's worth noting that those machines are single-phase up to about 4 tons. So for larger homes or small commercial, I've got a lot of projects with multiple single-phase, in some cases, condenser units at 3 or 4 tons each. And then the last thing on Mark's presentation, the question of whether to use 2 single-port machines or 1 2-port multi-port has actually come up for us several times, and usually it depends on capacity of the system that we're, you know, what are we actually trying to do in the building. The 2-port systems are fairly limited in their capacity, most of the manufacturer's products, so we have on occasion used 2 single-port machines. On Bob's presentation, and Bob, we're so grateful for the measurements that you folks are actually doing to have some data, because we have really had a lot of confusion with the AHRI ratings, particularly on the VRF machines, being, we think, a lot lower than the actual performance of the systems. At this stage, we have probably over the last 3 years, I don't know how many projects we have, dozen to 2 dozen buildings out there with these machines, up to maybe 11,000 square feet, as many as 18 zones. And with super insulated buildings, from a school retrofit to new super insulated houses, we're seeing performance in sort of Massachusetts, New Hampshire climates of roughly 1 kWh per square foot heating. So after many years of struggling with ground source heat pumps and finding that the units were not making what the manufacturers claimed for efficiency, and the tremendous cost and the commissioning problems and headaches we've had with ground source heat pumps, we haven't touched a ground source heat pump now in several years, and we haven't had a single call back or problem with one of the mini splits. And that, to me, is, you know, it gives us the opportunity to concentrate on other things besides fixing the damn heat pump. So we've got a bunch of buildings out there with photovoltaics and mini-split heat pumps, and once we sort of plug everything in, they seem to just run. We see the same thing in terms of the cost savings over fossil fuels, and we actually think that it may be greater than the simple numbers indicate with the efficiency numbers, because what we see in lower load buildings, you know, so we see this in our retrofit work, is that the efficiency of that boiler that's there, which is the predominant unit that you'll find in a northeast house, is not actually nearly that high because it doesn't run very often. So it's on and off and on and off. And I did some data logging of my oil boiler in the house that I bought here on Martha's Vineyard last December, and it was making hot water. When it was making hot water in an indirect fired tank, it was working at around a 15% system efficiency. So, you know, we're we think that there are that as the buildings get better performing, that the fossil fuel systems, at least maybe everything except for these extremely low mass, you know, condensing units, are really not working at those numbers that we always put in our spreadsheets for efficiency, whereas we think the mini splits are working at better than what the manufacturers claim. And certainly I haven't done anything like Bob has done with the flow, the airflow out of these units, but looking at our building models ahead of time and what we expect, and then looking at the degree days that the buildings are operating in and their internal gains, we're seeing what we think are COPs, are real COPs of 2.5 or better in the maybe middle generation machines. And then I've got a Fujitsu 12 RLS in my own house, and I'm convinced from looking at how little I've used after switching from oil to that heat pump. I mean, barely over 1,000 kilowatt hours since Christmas for 1,300 square feet in a Boston-type climate, that they are actually, that Fujitsu is working at a COP of 3 or better. The other thing that I've noticed about what I think is an efficiency choice that the occupant gets to make, we started using that just after Christmas, and we set the machine back at night to 62, like we were doing with the oil boiler, and then turned it up when we were there to a set point of 70. And it didn't look like we were saving anything versus a milder setback to 66, because once the differential between the room set point and what you put on into your controller gets more than, I think it's 4 degrees in the Fujitsu, it varies from manufacturer to manufacturer, the machine is going to run at full speed until it gets within that 4 degrees difference. And, of course, as your data shows, Bob, the efficiency of the machine at full speed is lower. So it seems like we actually can have a little better comfort, not as deep setbacks, for probably the same amount of kilowatt hours as we would get with a deeper setback that we might be more used to with something like a one-speed either gas furnace, let's say, or electric heat pump. Oh, and I guess the one thing that you showed me today, Bob, that I was very curious about was when you showed the measurements of HSPF and you showed the comparison between the Mitsubishi Hyperheat unit and the Fujitsu, it was interesting to me to see how they were different and close to what the manufacturer claimed in zone 4, where they're rated, and how they converge to very similar HSPF in zone 5 and colder. And I'm curious if you have any insights to share about that.
Well, when you go out and buy one of these, you look at it on the lot, the sticker will have an HSPF in SEER, and it's usually zone 4, which is essentially Washington, D.C. weather. Zone 5 is colder places. Our field experience and lab experience with these two models, we were quite interested in the cold weather, which for us was anything below, say, 20 degrees or even colder. There is a convergence on the manufacturer's rating. The performance in the lab and in the field is between the two is also quite similar. And actually, the RLS comes out a little bit ahead, but not, a huge amount. But it's significant that it isn't advertised as a cold climate system, but it actually works as well as or better than the Hyperheat, at least now. But I think the way these things go is that these manufacturers, they leapfrog each other a little bit every time they have a product, a new product. For our purposes in the Northern Tier, I hope that continues to happen with, for these, at least there's a couple to choose from if you're doing this kind of installation. But there is a convergence there on the ratings, and the actual performance in the field was also very similar in the lab, and also out in the field.
Bob, have you seen systems that are currently in production that you would recommend not purchasing based on performance?
Yes, but the very first one in my presentation, although maybe I shouldn't mention it by name.
Yeah,
The one that they sponsored, the NCAA Final Four, they're in court for other product problems for other appliances. Don't buy that one.
Yeah.
four main manufacturers that we've looked at in the field, Mitsubishi, Fujitsu, Daikin, and LG. The one with the shortest name or the initials is the one I'm talking about.
I think
we've used Sanyo as well. And
Sanyo, yes. There's some
been satisfied.
Not as many of those. Yeah.
We've been satisfied with that product as well.
In terms of performance at low temperatures, it seems like that's one of the issues that has been a major barrier to people using heat pumps, is the assumption that it wouldn't carry the load at low temperatures. So it seems like, Mark, what you're saying is you're seeing better performance at low temperatures with the most recent generation of ductless heat pumps, and your evidence, Bob, seems to verify that as well.
Yeah, just check the model and look for the output tables and see if they have any that are down in those lower bins, you know, 15, 10, 5. If not, then don't get that one. Or get the ones that we discussed here or show results for right now are ones that, are, as far as I can tell, really do work when it's very cold. When you walk into a house and it's 16 below in Helena and there's 95 degree air coming out of the ductless heat pump, the homeowner says, I thought these things were supposed to turn off at zero. And I say, well, is it off? No, it's running at 16 below, it's putting out 95 degree air, so that's the proof, seeing it in real life.
A couple questions came up regarding the expected life, the maintenance, and I wondered if both Marks could address from their experience the issue of what maintenance is required, and do you see things that contribute either to a shorter life or longer life? I realize we don't have many systems that have been in for an extended period of time. And one question was, why wouldn't you need gauges to do maintenance?
I would say that the main portion of the maintenance needs to be coils being kept clean and filters being washed. There's no reason to verify refrigerant in these systems. You can't tell what the gauge pressures are supposed to be. I mean, with the multitude of different possibilities of where that unit should be running, the gauges are not really going to give you any answer of what's going on. So refrigerant gauges are virtually useless unless you have a problem. So no need for maintenance. You know, just keeping the coils clean. And I would say that this ductless heat pump I put in was in 1985, and it was, I think it was a Sanyo. It didn't have the inverter technology, and that system lasted for, I believe it was still in 15-plus years later and still operates. I would say life expectancy of, I would imagine that we wouldn't see things lasting 15 to 20 years.
Linda, one of the things that we're really paying attention to these days is we make sure that the units aren't installed on the eave under the drip line, because we have seen in a couple of cases a badly installed unit operating at, you know, around 30 when it's very wet out, building up a lot of frost. So we make an effort to make sure that these things are out of the drip line.
Great point. Other comments on the issue of expected life, or what would it simply be? Poor output would be an indication that somebody used the wrong nut and didn't install the system correctly and has a refrigerant leak.
Yeah, I think that proper installation is going to be your biggest longevity possibility of problems. If it's not installed properly, wiring issue. The refrigerant nut, the flare nut not being the proper nut, you know, giving the possibility of a refrigerant leak can definitely create an issue of longevity.
Great. Well, it's time to close now. I've got a few announcements to make, but wanted to clarify on slide 93 what you're the ones as participants who are contributing the agenda for Thursday. We'll be organizing your questions in order to efficiently and effectively address them. If folks have comments they'd like to make, and let me know that, we can unmute those of you who would like to have comments if time permits. And we'd also like to take people's comments and share them with others if you would like those comments to be shared. So that information was contained in the email that I sent out with the headline, I think, reminder for the coming webinar. I guess it varied depending on what time it came in. The last two slides, there are a lot of classes that PG&E offers, some specifically related directly to deep energy reductions. Many of their calendar of hundreds of classes support anyone trying to save energy and trying on the path to deep reduction. So check, if you're in the California area, check out their calendar, and also some of their events are online, so that means other folks could participate without being physically present as well. And the last slide, 1,000 Home Challenge resources, the two dates for the webinars are coming up, as well as our next couple of events. So keep those things, mark those things on your schedule. So I'd like to thank Mark, and Bob for their work in preparing and developing, delivering this webinar, and thank all of you for participating. Thank you.
Thank you.